there are those of us who help and those who live to help. How far would you really go to do unto others? In the new book, Strangers Drowning, grappling with impossible idealism, drastic choices, and the overpowering urge to help, New Yorker writer Larissa McFarquhar digs deep into the psychological roots and existential dilemmas motivating those rare individuals practicing lives of extreme ethical commitment. She seeks out people who devote themselves fully to bettering the lives of strangers. The name again of the book is Strangers Drowning, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Larissa McFarquhar to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Joe, for having me on.
Very nice to have you with us. What led you to this subject, to think in this way?
You know, I've always been interested in the question of how much can morality require of us. I think, you know, most of us are. Most of us are plagued by that question. And it occurred to me, you know, why don't I look at the lives of people who have answered that question in the most extreme possible way, that morality can require everything of us, everything we can possibly give, and see what their lives are like. Are these a group of tormented, guilty people, or are they a group of joyful, purposeful people, or are they people who are just more or less like us? And it was really the latter two answers I discovered. You know, these are people who certainly don't behave like most of us do, but they feel the same things. They are tormented by the same questions and driven by the same urges, and they just come out with a different answer, that they owe more to others than most of us think we do.
And it gets down to these questions of what we value most, and why we value those things.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, it's, you know, when I started thinking about people who lived extremely moral lives and why most of us don't, I thought, well, you know, the usual answer is we're just weak, or we're selfish, we're lazy, we like our stuff too much to give it up, you know, that kind of thing. And all of that's true, of course. But I felt that there was something deeper pushing against most of us living more moral lives or giving more than we do. And one of the things I came to feel was that one of the deepest reasons was that most of us want to give everything we can to our families and the people we love. We want to give to people close to us. And we not only do we think that that is what we want to do, but we think it's the right thing to do, that we should give everything we can to people close to us before we turn our attention to anybody else. But this is one of the deeper differences between us and the sort of people I'm writing about in my book, is that they believe that strangers are just as valuable as the people they love. And even though they love their families just as much as anyone, they don't stop there. And so, you know, let me give you an example. I mean, for instance, one man and his wife, Baba Amte and Thai Amte, who founded a leprosy colony in the center of India about 60 years ago, they moved to a wild. They were given some land by the state, but this land was terrible land. It was wilderness. It was surrounded by rocks and scrub. There was very little water, and there were lots of wild animals roaming around. And he moved there. He and his wife moved there with their two tiny boys, who were then both, I think, under the age of two. And they also brought with them some dogs to protect them. And they and the leprosy patients moved there to build a community. And in the early days, every one of the dogs, I think there were four, was carried off and eaten by tigers sneaking into the huts at night. And the children, the two babies, were not, but they might well have been. And we now know that leprosy is actually not very contagious, but it wasn't known then that that was the case. And so these little boys could also have caught leprosy. They didn't, but they might have done. This is the level of risk to which a truly committed do-gooder is willing to put their family, and many people balk at that.
I want to get into that, and you write about it in the book, and it's fascinating, of why we do balk about that. You use the term do-gooder. When we call someone that, there is often great skepticism in it, even, as you point out, hostility. So the question that you wrestle with, and the question that I'll ask you, of why do these people, moral people, make us feel uneasy?
Well, you know, I think part of it is, again, there are certain obvious answers that come to mind, right? So we feel they might make us a very moral person, even if they say nothing to us about how we ought to live. We might feel implicitly rebuked by them. We might feel guilty that we're not doing as much as they are. And these are annoying emotions, right? I mean, no one wants to be made to feel guilty or to feel as though they are being implicitly preached to about how they should live their lives. But again, I think there's something more to it. And I think the part of the resistance is a long history of suspicion of altruism that has come about more in the West than in the rest of the world. And I became very intrigued by this suspicion because I was, you know, puzzled by the extent of skepticism and hostility that the people I'm writing about had encountered. And I ended up kind of tracing a history. You know, there were, for instance, to take a kind of strain in popular culture, Al-Anon, the group founded by spouses of alcoholics, introduced the idea that one of the prototypical virtuous figures of the 19th century, the long-suffering spouse of an alcoholic trying to get her husband, typically her husband, to stop drinking, that person was, in fact, not so much virtuous as a kind of addict herself, that trying to help someone, trying to change someone's life who is struggling can be an addiction as harmful to both parties as alcoholism itself. And this idea was a very strange idea and made a lot of moral behavior look quite different. And it mutated into a larger concept, codependency, which became very popular in, you know, pop therapeutic culture in the 1980s and afterwards. And this is the idea that not just the spouse of an alcoholic, but anyone who tries to help other people, tries to change their lives, tries to change their behavior, can be seen as unhealthy, as addicted, as trying to control people for their own purposes. And so this cast what used to be an appealing kind of moral behavior into a very different light and made trying to live even a slightly more ethical life seem less appealing than it used to.
I was speaking a while ago to someone who was running a food pantry, and I said to them, how do you deal with the overwhelming need and knowing that you don't come anywhere near to helping everyone who is in need in the community? And they said to me, you can't look at it that way. You can't look at it as we're trying to solve the problem of hunger. You have to look at it as we are helping as many people as we are able to at a given time. And we ultimately have to make that decision as to how many people that is. And I guess that kind of put it into terms for me that we do have to set up boundaries. But as you write in this book, some people do and some people don't.
Well, this is one of the hardest things for a morally driven person to do, is to set up those boundaries. But it's also the most necessary, because if you are the kind of person that I'm writing about, someone who feels the suffering of strangers as vividly as if they were a person right in front of them. So, for instance, one young man I spoke to, the way he wanted to live an altruistic life was to give to strangers abroad, because he felt that strangers in third world countries were suffering more than those nearer him, and he wanted to give to them, even though he had never met them and had only a fuzzy idea of what their lives were like. But he felt their suffering as vividly, as urgently as if they were in front of him. However, someone like that still has to put up parameters. So it's very difficult if you are that kind of person, if you can really feel the suffering that most of us really know about intellectually, but don't necessarily feel as though we could see it. How do you, at a certain point, close your eyes and say, okay, I, for my own sanity, in order to sustain this commitment for the long haul, I have to stop now. And it's very, very hard. You know, it's a slow process. I mean, one couple I wrote about, I saw this happening in real time because I was interviewing them over the course of 4 years. And when I started talking to them, they were both about 25. And now, 5 years later, they're 30. And in the course of that time, the woman of the couple, Julia Wise, who is the more morally driven of the two, had to make two very important decisions, two of the most important decisions anyone makes in their life, what career path to follow and whether or not to have children. And in both these cases, because she was such a morally driven person and felt the need to alleviate suffering that could rather than pay attention to her own needs, these were crises for her. What she really wanted to do was become a social worker. She'd always wanted to be a social worker. She loved the idea of the work, but she knew that if she became a social worker, the pay would be very low, and that would restrict her ability to give money to charities and thus restrict the amount of money those charities had to save lives. And so she felt, if I become a social worker, I will be, in effect, hurting other people. And she struggled with that for a long time, but she decided ultimately, you know, this is the course of sanity. I have to, you know, if I commit myself to some career that I loathe and become desperately unhappy in, I maybe will lose the ultimate commitment to giving to charity. So she decided to pursue social work. And then the other decision was having a child. And again, she realized, you know, having a child is about the most expensive, non-essential thing I can possibly have. So by having my own child, I will, in effect, be killing somebody else's child because the money I spend on my own child is money that I will not be sending to a charity which will be saving lives abroad. And again, this was a great struggle for her. Ultimately, she decided, I'm going to have a child because if I do not, that is the point at which I feel my life is not just constrained, but blighted. And I will probably lose the commitment that I have to giving money to charity. She and her husband, I should say, give now they give 50% of their before tax income to charity. They previously gave even more before they had a child. So they are very, very committed, but they realized, and this was an incredibly important process for them, that in order to sustain this commitment, they had to set up parameters. They had to make limits for themselves.
And of course, one of the things that you wrestle with in the book as you're reading this is, of course, in so many of the stories that you tell, is you immediately put yourself into it and say, well, okay, what would I do? Mm-hmm. And one of the other things that's fascinating is that, as you point out, we don't really know what the right answers are.
It's very, very difficult. You know, I think it's safe to say that almost all of us could give more than we do. But whether it's the right thing to do to value your family on a par with strangers, that's a much harder question. This is the philosophical problem that gave my book its title, Strangers Drowning. This is a sort of old philosophical puzzle that's given to college students often. If you're a mother or your child or your wife or some relative is drowning over here and two or three strangers are drowning over there, and you could save one or the other, what should you do? And, of course, if it's only one stranger, everyone saves their loved one. But what if it's two or three or four or five? At what point do you start to feel that it's the wrong thing to do to save this member of your family, this person that you deeply love? And that is a very, very difficult problem and one that I don't think has a definite answer. Some very rigorous utilitarians, a certain kind of philosopher who believes that all people are equal and therefore we have no right to privilege our family over anyone else, would say if there are two strangers and one loved one, you must save the strangers. But very few people, even philosophical utilitarians, believe that it can be pushed that far. So it's a very, very tough question.
Larissa McFarquhar has been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1998. Her new book, Strangers Drowning, Grappling with Impossible Idealism, Drastic Choices, and the Overpowering Urge to Help. The book is published by Penguin Press. Larissa, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me on.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book is Strangers Drowning and is published by Penguin Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.